Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Thank you and good evening, everybody. Good evening. I'm so happy to be here with you all in the space of practice tonight. So one of the elements of Buddhist teaching, as I'm sure many of you are familiar with, are the paramitas, which can also be known as the perfections. There are a certain number of qualities that are associated with practice and enlightenment. A Buddha is somebody who would be nurturing the qualities of the paramitas, the perfections. And in general, they're listed as 10. There are 10 different ones, and altogether they're a huge subject, far bigger than anything we have time for this evening. But there's one of them that's been standing out to me more than the others recently, and so I wanted to share some reflections about that with you this evening, and then maybe invite some reflections back from you on the subject, if you feel any resonance with this offering this evening. So the paramita that I feel quite close to my heart at the moment is virya, which is often translated as something like energy, effort, exertion, even willpower. And for me, the practice of virya is the invitation to examine what I'm bringing to my practice energetically, or rather how I'm turning to practice, you know, with what attitudes, what faculties am I bringing. Virya can be seen as the exertion of turning impurity into purity, the avoidance of unwholesomeness and the nurturing of wholesomeness. That's often how it's characterized. And so one image that comes up for me, and I'm going to share my screen with you real quick, is this one here, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. This is a han that hangs at the entrance to many practice halls, many zendos. And the han is what is struck several times in a particular pattern in the period just before zazen, just before a period of meditation. And it's kind of a call, like a bell that would sound to bring pupils into a classroom. We strike the han to bring us into the zendo. And it's a tradition on many hans that I've seen to paint this little verse that always seems to be different on every han that I've seen, just slightly different. And yet there's something very important that they all have in common. And that is that they are a very, very urgent call to practice, a very urgent call to awakening. Something like, listen, everyone. Birth and death are given only once. And something like, this moment is one. Just one moment passing, this moment is gone, Awake, each one, awake. Don't waste this life. So if you're, maybe you're at Canando, when we're there in person, or maybe at a temple, at a practice center somewhere, I think that particular han might've been photographed at Tassajara. That wood is sounded, and maybe you're somewhere nearby doing something and you hear the wood and you drop everything and think, ah, ready, zazen, and start, you know, moving yourself towards the meditation hall. In my case, often running, because I just have I'm just genetically late for everything. But I've observed in myself this kind of reflex action of like sound of the wood, start running, start moving. And sometimes many times over the years, I've been running late and I run because I was doing something that I didn't stop doing immediately. And so that made me late. And if I want to make it into the Zendo on time, then I have to run. And I think one of the best pieces of advice I ever received from anybody was, if you are late and you're running for something, just slow down, just slow down. And I'm still practicing with that. Because when I'm late for something, I feel like I'm at school again. You know, I feel like there's this sense of, well, I'm going to be in trouble now. There's going to be trouble if I don't make it there on time. And maybe I won't get in trouble, but if I'm late, somebody will think badly of me. You know, I'm going to fall in someone's eyes. You know, maybe somebody will think that I'm lazy or negligent. So with these thoughts going through my head, you know, sometimes I'll stop and think to myself, well, what is my motivation here? Is it really the threat of reprimand? Do I really want to please people who are in authority? Am I fearful of being publicly shamed? So this is a rousing question for me. Like, what's my motivation? What is it that's driving me? What's yours? How is it different from mine? So virya, energy, effort, is a very important component of practice. Because fundamentally, practice requires effort to show up to a meditation center, or to sit on a cushion, to find a teacher, to learn, maybe read a couple of books. Even the act of meditation itself can take effort, especially at first. Sometimes someone might come to practice and sit for a few weeks and find that their thinking mind is still ticking over, even after a few weeks, let alone months or years. And that can be demotivating. And if that happens to us, we might think that we're failing or that we're doing something wrong. So we try harder. Because maybe the problem is that we're not exerting enough energy. We're not putting in enough effort. Maybe we're not dedicated enough to this. So you really go for it. Give it horns. Full speed ahead. And that effort can be a very, very tricky thing. The image that came up for me was, it can be a bit like salt. Too little, too much, you ruin the dish. You know, getting it just right. Like, that's the skill that we practice. That's it's a very core skill for Buddhist practitioners. So I have a little story that reads a little bit like a joke. It's kind of a Zen story with a punchline. And it goes like this. Maybe you've heard it already. I think it's a well-known one. So there's a martial arts student who went to his teacher, and he's a new student, so he's very earnest. And he says to his teacher, "I am completely devoted to studying your martial arts system. How long will it take me to master it?" And the teacher was kind of casual. He said, 10 years. And the student became really impatient. He's like, but 10 years? Like, no, like, I want to get there faster than that. Like, I'm going to work hard. You know, I'm dedicated. I'm going to practice every day, 10 hours, 12 hours, if I need to, whatever it takes. How long will it take me then? And the teacher thinks for a moment. And he says, 20 years. So that story would suggest the harder we try, the further away we get. And, you know, I was reading some chapter from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind recently, and Suzuki was saying, and I think this was related to something even Les was talking about a few weeks ago, about, you know, right energy, having the effort in our practice. And Suzuki said, you know, the right energy is very important. And there was such a thing, according to him, as bad effort. It's the kind of effort that becomes too excitable. He would talk about that, you know, the importance of steadiness, that practice should be very ordinary. Practice is something that can be regular, steady. If it becomes too excitable, it becomes something else. So this kind of steadiness, you know, this kind of structure, this suggestion within practice to practice, and especially start practicing a small amount every day, you know, something that's achievable, something that's doable. And this is a way to build a strong foundation. So this would be a kind of antidote to too much energy, because too much effort might not be appropriate, can be overbearing. And in Suzuki's words, it's the kind of effort that moves things in the wrong direction. So what does that mean, for efforts to move in the wrong direction? I think the image that comes up for me is, you know, the obvious one of, you know, maybe swimming against the current. I was thinking about the other day, I went on a really long bike ride down at Shoreline, and I was cycling north, in the direction of north, and there was a really strong wind coming the other way, like a sort of a southeasterly wind blowing about 18 miles an hour. It was really hard for me, who's not a professional cyclist, as I think many of those gathered here probably are. But it's something that for me was a very pleasant, usually normally pleasant activity, just became something really unpleasant. And I became very grouchy about the fact that I just had to keep pushing against this wind. And sometimes when the road curved, you know, sharply to the point where I was almost in tune with the wind, and I realized just how easily I could go along and be pushed by it. It made me even more grumpy that I then had to go back into it. So that kind of feeling, you know, that kind of feeling, that sort of that sense of, you know, pedaling uphill, swimming against the current, cycling against the wind. So Dogen would say that the quality of the energy that we bring to our practice is important, is paramount. And in one of the texts, sorry, of his that I read, he said the kind of energy necessary to cultivate. And he uses these examples, which I think are wonderful. He says either similar intensity to a thief trying to steal a jewel, or a warrior fighting a formidable enemy, or someone who was in love, who was trying to win favor of their beloved. Now, so some very, very like strong forms of determination there. And I think what these examples have in common is that the energy to act in all of these examples is something that just naturally arises. It doesn't have to be forced. It doesn't have to be generated, you know, or like just willed into existence by sheer volition. You know, it's just there. It comes up. So an image that resonates with me, for example, you know, when this kind of energy comes up really naturally is with my daughter as a parent. I remember when she was first learning to walk, or learning to ride a bike for the first time, like out on the road. And, you know, that sort of sense of attentiveness of, you know, being right next to her and just alive to her every micro movement, because if she, you know, overbalances or falls, then like, I want to be there. Like, I want to be there to catch her. There's this sort of somatic readiness to dive in if something goes wrong, and it's just, you know, it just goes from second to second. A lot of presence there. And it's not something that I needed to generate, this kind of focus. It was already there. It is already there, and it runs through me. As a parent, I'm hardwired to protect my child. So biologically speaking, I practically have no choice. The effort is already there in abundance. So in some ways, a lot of these examples that I've just mentioned are a little extraordinary. Stealing precious jewels and, you know, falling in love, being with your children. So what about the energy of practice? You know, going back to the energy of practice, practice of the ordinary, practice in everyday life, practice sitting on the cushion, which in general are not dangerous, you know, or particularly extraordinary activities. So how to bring in that kind of effort in that moment, and how to sustain it over a long period of time? I think that's a question that has stayed with me for a long time. And again, going back to Dogen, he says, well, this can't just be done by thinking about it, you know, by some temporary method of contemplation. It's not just gonna come because we will it to. Not that simple. And neither can it be created from nothing and just, you know, and thought about in that way. Instead, he said that in order to arouse this mind of practice, we need to be deeply aware and intimate with impermanence. Intimate with impermanence. This is key. It's this idea that if, you know, thirst leads you to water, hunger leads you to food, tiredness leads you to sleep, then the keen awareness of impermanence will naturally guide you into spiritual practice. Because thirst, when it appears, it has this way of just taking you to water. You know, it's not something you have to think about. You might not even be aware of it. Thirst can be like an underlying condition. It's not necessarily foremost a lot of the time. maybe before you realize that you're thirsty, you might notice that you're a little bit distracted, cranky. Maybe you're being short with people. Maybe you have a headache, something like this. And then finally you realize, oh, okay, thirsty. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you don't even have, maybe that thought doesn't even come so literally. You just reach for a bottle of water while you're talking to somebody and have a sip. You know, your arm just does it. And the longer you go without water, the more your body will and your mind will sink into crisis, and the more energy and focus you'll put into putting out your thirst. So this is, you know, this is my reflection, or this is my understanding of Dogen's teaching about effort, because spiritual thirst works in a similar way. We might not always recognize the symptoms at first, but the deeper intelligence of our being will invariably lead us in the right direction. And so what are the kind of things that give rise to spiritual thirst? Sickness, old age, death. And what holds all of these things in common, according to the teachings of the Buddha, is impermanence. The truth that things change, that things are not static, that things evolve and arise and fall away. And it's this that causes our little human minds to tie itself up into knots of despair. But because these are the things that cause us to suffer, these can also be the things that fuel our efforts to direct us to what is nourishing, what is healing. If we can be skillful in reading ourselves, reading the signs. So just a few weeks ago, I spoke with a dear friend who had just recently lost a beloved pet. And it was really a devastating experience for them, both in their heart from the love that they had for this dear, dear family member. And then also in the deeper existential sense of their being, as there was this sort of feeling of reeling in the face of loss. And I think for this person, and this impacted me, what was especially strong, or I guess unique about this experience of loss, was that they were holding their pet, you know, in the animal hospital as they were put to sleep. So they literally had the animal in their hands, as one moment they were alive and the next moment they were dead. And this prompted me to have the following reflection, that in as much as death represents impermanence, in some ways, I don't think that this is what is so jarring about it for most folks. I actually somehow think it's the opposite. I think it's the impression of permanence, of something that is gone forever, and that is this irreversibility that is not present at in any other part of our lives, that really causes some strong emotions to arise in us. And as I spoke to this friend that day, what came up for me was confusion and not understanding. Really like a sort of a mental wall And as a result of that, what came up for me and what's come up for me previously in moments of loss is a kind of anger as well in the face of that. Because there's something that seems so completely counterintuitive. So when something like this happens, a strong experience like this happens and it's close to our hearts, it can give rise to very, very strong emotion, very strong emotion. It can sometimes be anger or something close to anger. And this can be very motivating, very, very motivating. And what I, in researching this talk, I discovered a notion in Theravada Buddhism called Samvega that I hadn't come across before. And Samvega is a Buddhist term which indicates a sense of shock and dismay and a sort of a spiritual urgency, like a spiritual crisis that pushes somebody to reach liberation, to escape suffering. And according to the Theravadan teacher, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Samvega is the first emotion you're supposed to bring to training. The first emotion you're supposed to bring to training. So I thought that was interesting in the light of all of this. So I'm not saying that you have to be angry to have enough motivation for practice. It's an option, but I don't think it's a necessity. Rather than, I think what I want to say or what I'd like to offer you this evening is that already each of us contains so much of that fuel if we know where to find it. It could be anger, it could equally be fear, it could be awe, it could be joy, it could be longing. You trust yourselves. You trust yourself, your body, your heart. There's a nice exchange between a master and a student that I came across recently when the student asked the master, what's the most direct way to obtain Buddha's wisdom? And the master answers him, there's nothing more direct than this question. So when the question arises, when the desire is there, when the effort is aroused, the way is wide open. It reminds me of something that I used to hear a lot in the days of the beginning of my practice from many of the teachers in France where I practiced. And when I had lots of questions, As a new student, some of the teachers would say to me, don't worry too much. Don't worry too much about this practice. Don't worry about the Zazen. It'll take care of itself. It'll take care of itself. There's a very deep faith in that conviction. So I'd like to end this evening by offering you a quote from the teacher Kōbun Jinō. When you realize how rare and precious your life is and how it's completely your responsibility, how you live it, how you manifest it, that's such a big responsibility that naturally, such a person sits down for a while. It's not an intended action. It's a natural action. Thank you. Love to invite any comments, responses, a greeting to Sandra, who sent a gassho through the comment, through the chat. Any questions? Any passionate disagreement? Dan, your hands went straight up. You're like,
on that note, on the great matter of birth and death, I think I've been focusing much more on death for quite a while. And I think that we forget about birth, and you mentioned joy as and awe as qualities to, you know, along with the matter of death and sickness and old age. And I'm looking for more balance personally, just myself, you know, and I'm starting. And that leads to another question I've been thinking more along the line of attitude, which is, you know, how do I energize my practice so that it's happier? You know, because I just need that. I mean, it's kind of selfish. I just need more of it. And I think effort and attitude are very much related. Do you agree? I mean, I just think, to me, they are almost the same thing. But I don't mean to be concerned with the great matter of death, but you know it. I need more balance, and I kind of feel like a lot of people need more balance now. So that's my
problem. What is it, Dan, about death that's so damn attractive?
I know, it's like, you know, I just keep listening to it and hearing and thinking it, right? And it's you know, because it's, yeah. I guess it's a mystery we don't understand, you know, so.
It is. And I think that, I think you're right, you know, that not nearly so much airtime is given to birth. And yet it's a mystery of equal quantity. I mean, you know, it's just as mysterious, the question of where something came from as to where it goes. But we get so caught up in the joys of birth, or at least, you know, that's the way we're conditioned to respond to birth of most things, right? And then we're taught to respond with fear and anxiety around death. And yet, yeah, in so many ways, they're so similar. so similar.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, I was thinking that we're, you know, our practice is too focused on death. But then, you know, Dogen said birth and death, right? The great matter of birth and death. And maybe it's just, you know, what our focus is, right? Sometimes.
Mm.
Yeah. And I guess also, you know, we don't have any control over our birth, but we believe that we have control over our death, right? How we live it, how we diet, right? So what happens? How can I influence that? Yet, you know, it'd be interesting to think of it the other way around, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Or I don't exactly know how to do that, but it's something maybe I should think about now. Okay. Thank you.
There's so much there, Dan. So rich. Thank you. Diane.
Thank you, Vanessa. You talked about effort, making good effort. And I think there's a danger in effort having a goal or an endpoint or an attainment of some sort. And I'm wondering what you think about that. I mean, I don't believe we ever really arrive there or attain some kind of a goal or a difference. I think it's the practice itself and putting the effort into sitting and being in the present moment. And then you mentioned thoughts, and it's not as if the thoughts are ever going to go away. I think the thoughts, for me anyway, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, that they're always there. They're always traveling through. They never really go away. I think it's what we do with the thoughts, whether we hang on to them or whether we say, oh, go away. So I think it's just a process and the being present and doing the practice. It's difficult not to also think that there's some end point or some goal or that you're going to get somewhere. So your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Diane. My thoughts about thoughts, which are still whirling around. In invoking, for example, the paramitas, which are ironically called the perfections, and there's this idea there. Well, how do you perfect this? How does this perfection happen? And of course, it doesn't. It's practice. So we can have an idea of what perfect virya, perfect generosity, any practice of perfection would look like, and that's a concept. It's an image or maybe a point of arrival, but it's a point of arrival that nobody ever arrives at. But it's a direction of practice. It's the same as when we make our vow, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. We make these absolutely unattainable vows, knowing that it's impossible, but it's just the direction that the river's flowing.
Mm.
That's the way that we're going. And so in talking about effort, I think that's what's so important, because in our minds, effort, ordinarily, in the ordinary sense of effort, effort is something that brings us to a goal. You have to make an effort to study so you do well in your exams. You have to make an effort to run the 10-minute mile, whatever. And it's precisely this effortless effort, goalless practice, that when we can tune in to this kind of effort or energy that is different from the kind of effort that we associate with a goal.
Mm.
It is a kind of naturally arising effort that is already there, and then move with that. So, and I was thinking about this the other day, Diane. I was there in the ocean with my bodyboard. I love to go bodyboarding, And you're there in the ocean, and I'm holding my board, and the waves are huge, and I'm being knocked around, like trying to stand there. But there's this practice of just like, the reason I love it is because I'm there and I'm waiting, and the waves are coming, and I could try one wave and it's not a very good one, like it'll only take me so far, and then I'll just kind of like crash into the sand. And then there can be a moment where maybe two or three waves just kind of gather up one on top of each other, and in a split, there's no time for thinking, just in a split second I can intuit this one, take it, boom, and it'll take me 100 feet to the shore.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what for me, that's what virya is. And that's that kind of effort that Dogen's talking about. It's something to tune into. It's a wind to catch in your sail, rather than a kind of exertion that that takes you to a particular place.
Mm. Thank you.
That would, yeah.
Love your answer.
Seen a message here from Edna. The kids are asleep. Okay. So, there's Edna. I see you. Your children are asleep. Thank you, Edna. I hope your kids sleep well. Dave.
Thank you so much for your talk, Vanessa. Lots to digest and chew on there. You mentioned at one point about a teacher telling a student, I guess a beginning student, not to worry too much, just to experience the practice and you know, be there, be present with it. And it reminded me of something in one of Suzuki Roshi's talks, where he compared practice to being a passenger on a train. And of course, there are some obvious pitfalls to avoid there, like spending your entire time on the train, thinking about where the train is going and feeling impatient about getting to the destination so you can get off the train and so forth. But the thing that he focused on in this talk was that you also don't want to spend your entire time on the train worrying about the rails. He said, don't worry about the rails. It's not your responsibility to take care of the rails. Somebody else will take care of the rails. Buddha will take care of the rails. I always thought that was a wonderful image. You know? Don't let your experience on the train be completely muddled by just impatience to get there and get off. But also, don't spend your whole time worrying about the underpinnings and the rails and when the wheels come off. Just experience the journey.
I love that. That's great. Thank you, Dave. Especially just because it does start me now. I never thought about train rails. How could, you know, in the question, well, what is there to worry about? Train rails, the mind begins to boggle. Now I worry that I'm going to worry about train rails. Thank you, though. Thank you for introducing a new anxiety. I didn't know it was possible.
Now you're making me afraid to mention.
I'm going to read Ednan's question in the chat. You mentioned that as a mother, you're hardwired to protect your daughter. Do you think that we all are also hardwired for spiritual practice? And sometimes we may not pay attention enough or have the time, or we may fail to make the time to practice as we wish. I wish you could talk, Ednan, because I would love to hear what your feeling is about it. But I can offer what comes up for me. Yes, I do. Do I think we're hardwired? I mean, hardwired is a tough word. It was my choice of word, so I'll take it. But I think we're oriented to spiritual practice. I think in another one of Suzuki Roshi's images, I think we are drops of water coming down the waterfall. But that spiritual life and an individual spiritual journey is something that has direction, and that it's easy to lose that direction and to lose sight of it and to maybe sometimes not even pick up on it at all. And I think the word that we use in our tradition is awakening, awakening to that. The idea of there being sleep and then of there being a kind of gradual stirring. And then an awareness. In my current job, if anyone doesn't know, I work as a interfaith hospital chaplain, resident in training at the moment. And so I on a daily basis talk with people from all sorts of different faiths, traditions, philosophies, and in valuing and upholding all of these differences that are between us. The differences of tradition, some very fundamental theological differences. I just can't help but feel with everybody, that there's a common direction, that there's just a common sense of, well, we use the phrase of coming home for everybody. that the spiritual practice or the spiritual journey leads in the same direction. I wonder if there are any other responses to Pednan's question. Yes, Sodo.
Yeah. I keep hearing this term hardwired come up quite a bit. And if we were hardwired to practice, then everybody would be practicing. And we wouldn't have a choice about it. Because it, just like a bee, you know, a bee's behavior is hardwired. Mm-hmm. And it's locked in. And it seems to me, if you look at the evolutionary ladder, the higher so-called higher up you go, the less and less behavior is determined by so-called wiring. And this term throws me. It's like, if Buddhism is a matter of being hardwired, then who cares? You know, who cares? You know? So I don't know. I just have to say that because it's this term of being hardwired and these questions of life and death. I think, you know, what's the source of the question? Why do we have those questions about it? And the practice, I don't know. I mean, for me anyway, you know, after a certain amount, at some point during practice, the questions became meaningless. They had no more relevance. They just, you know, we don't get concerned about a cloud disappearing, you know, or a wave rising and falling. You know, I think the practice is one of the things it does is liberate us from those questions. And maybe it's the source of the question that you got to get at, which, you know, I don't know. You know, there's a thing. There was a guy, Carlos Castaneda, wrote some books, and this guy was an anthropologist at UCLA, and he had wrote a book where he had a chapter called Self-Importance, losing self-importance. And at some point, what he described was that, you know, those questions come out of a sense of self-importance, and when you lose self-importance, those concerns aren't important. You know, sort of. I mean, that sort of was the way he sort of laid it out. I'm not sure if I got it all because he was a pretty esoteric guy. He, you know, he claimed all his stuff was true and real, and there was a bunch of debate about that. He was supposedly apprenticed to some Indian shaman who was teaching him the sorcerer's way and all this stuff. But I think it was just his vehicle for getting the truth out, you know, getting his views out. So I don't know. But I know this term hardwired is starting to get, I just don't get it. So anyway, that's just my opinion there.
Thank you anyway. So much. Thank you for sharing that. Teresa, did you just have a power cut?
Yeah, right now.
The lights just went out.
Just right now. It's been like that all night. I don't know what's happening. There's a short circuit and it keeps turning off. And right now when I was, but can you see me or at least hear me?
And blessedly your internet is still working. So let's run with it.
Yeah, I'm connected to the phone. anyway, thank you for your talk. As Dave said, there's a lot of things to think about. But related to what just is being discussed now and to something that you, a few things that you mentioned during your talk about your friends holding their pet while it was put asleep and how much they love their pet. And also, I think you also refer to the notion of trust and the body knowing what to do. And what I was thinking right now, it was the idea of maybe if we could turn off the thinking mind, just turn it off and just be like nature, like animals. And I got a cat recently, and I'm learning a lot observing her. And I wanted to ask you, I know you care a lot about your cats too, so have you learned any lessons by observing them?
I think that's a whole Dharma talk in itself, Teresa. that's the one that we've, even with Nick, we've been plotting that we need to have a whole evening dedicated to the poster animal for Zen practice, which I think is the cat, for sure. I also just got a new cat this weekend. And one of the things that I've been observing is the way in which the new cat and the old cat are negotiating their new shared territory together. And that's really something to see how, you know, I don't know, I would call emotions are arising in both of them, and such complex relationship that they have to one another and to us and to the space that they're in is really incredible. Really incredible. And I try not to project my own human experience onto what I'm seeing. I think it's easy to do that, but you know, I think sometimes then just observing the ways in which my cat, when she is calm, you know, in the middle of the day, she'll just come and sit on the edge of the table and then just sit and does nothing but just sits. And I just think, ah, you're good. Yeah. I wondered, Teresa, I didn't know that you'd got a new cat. And I'm wondering if you would like to share any learnings from being a new cat owner?
Yeah, just one second. sorry. Yes, a few things that I learned from the cat. So it's a cat that just showed up at my door one day, and I adopted her. And so then she became pregnant a few months ago, and she had 4 kittens. And what was interesting was to observe very closely how, you know, that she knows what to do. The night that she was going to have the kittens, she chose a place inside my closet to have the kittens. And so this idea that she knows what to do. And it made me think that as humans, many times we are like, oh, I don't know what to do. But, you know, if the cat knows what to do, we also have that there. We have to have that there, because this is transmitted right through many, many generations we have. So we have to have that knowledge there. And it's also interesting to look at the kittens. How, you know, if I put some food for them at the beginning, they will only eat it after the mother has eaten the food. So that was also interesting. It made me think of practice and this idea of trusting somebody when you don't have the knowledge, this idea maybe of having a teacher. You know, when you don't still have the knowledge, trusting somebody. And this is really big trust that the kittens have in the mother, because, you know, if you don't know if the food is going to be poison or not, so you choose, they wouldn't eat it if I serve it, but if the mother eats it, then they do. So that was also interesting to see. But especially this observing how she knows what to do and how this applies to our human life. Mm.
That's beautiful. Yes. so lucky to have had four kittens in your vicinity there.
I will give them to other people because there are too many cats.
Thank you, Teresa.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Vanessa.
Jaya.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I have to jump in if I hear about animals. But it also relates to what you were talking about, and that is a little bit about the discussion we had, is that the idea that animals, and I think we too, when we're in the practice, there's something like effortless effort where it just happens. It's like what you described on the board, body board. It just comes naturally. Is there really an effort at some point? I guess I wanted to know your thoughts. On the other hand, there's obviously times when, you know, there is a need to really exert that. And then there's, I see in my life that people around me that were, it does happen naturally, just like the animals do everything so naturally. And nature is so effortless. There are some people that have to struggle. And you see them struggling for that, to engage in spiritual practice. They want to go back to Hernan's question, they seem to want to, but they have to exert so much effort. So I don't know if you have thoughts on that and those differences.
Like why effort would come, why effort would be more effortless for some.
Yeah. Seems so unfair at some point.
I mean, there's all sorts of conditions in our lives, you know, that just make life and living so much more challenging for some people than others. You know, so much in Buddhism, you know, perhaps a scholar of Buddhism could better explain than I, you know, maybe perhaps karmic principles that are involved. You know, more popularly in our culture, we sort of turn to issues or rather factors of human nature, human nurture, conditions in which people were raised and the forces that we are subject to as children and growing into adulthood, the ways in which we're educated. Just so many factors, so many different ways that things can go well and that things can be difficult. I often think of notions like integration or attunement as being kind of modalities in which like navigation of the world is easier, you know, an integrated state where not one particular faculty is necessarily like overworked or underused with somebody. So, you know, maybe heart and mind and body and intuition and intellect can be balanced, you know, and brought together and integrated in that way. Then, you know, energetically and integrating with life and with the world can be smoother. And I think if, you know, some of those faculties are under or overdeveloped, then challenges can occur and things can feel more difficult. So it's kind of there's a pointing to balance there, I suppose, like a yeah, I think integration, attunement, balance. Those are the first places that I go to. Yeah. Do you have some thought about that, Jayashree?
No, I think what my only observation is that the more you practice, the less the effort you have to put. I mean, that's just what I found. And the less you practice, it's sort of a strange kind of a thing. That's just my observation. It's just a very simple relationship, is that the more you practice, the less the effort. It just becomes part of your life and part of the way you do things. So like the animals and nature, you know, they just do. So that's the only thought I have. And I think people struggle because they don't. It's sporadic. And like you said, there may be other conditions. I don't know what those pre-existing conditions are. But thank you for your answer, though. That was really very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. It looks like we're at time, in fact, over time, even. Just got away with us. So effortlessly did we sail past 9 o'clock. We didn't, or at least I didn't even realize. If there are no other questions.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.